VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, and thanks for joining me for another science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. From simple handheld digging sticks, sickles, hoes, the use of oxen, horses, and other beasts of burden that date back centuries, to the development of more advanced tools in the Industrial Revolution, such as the steel plow and the cotton gin, to late 19th and 20th century inventions like the tractor, baler, and harvester, technology has long played a very important role in agriculture. Like other aspects of modern life, agriculture is also now benefiting from recent advancements in high technology. Farmers today are using modern tools such as computers, satellite, wireless communications, robotics, automation, and biotechnology to help them produce high crop yields of needed foods that feed the world. Today, we'll talk about the use and impact of high technology in agriculture. Joining me today are three guests who, in three segments, will talk about various aspects of modern agricultural technology. My first guest in our opening segment is Ken Giles. He's a professor in the Department of Biological and Agricultural Engineering at the University of California, Davis. We'll talk about some of the up-to-date high-tech devices that are being developed for the modern farmer. Ken, some of the challenges that must be considered in agriculture include the need for water, good seeds, proper soil composition, fertilizers, pest and disease control, and of course the weather in general. How is modern technology helping farmers to face these challenges?
When we look at agriculture, it's really a biological process with a big logistics problem around it, where we need to get in these materials, the inputs, in a timely fashion, and then we need to remove the outputs or harvest the crop or whatever we're taking out. And agriculture has always been incredibly adaptable because we don't control the weather. So many of these things we don't control. We try to control as much as we can, but we respond to them. And so what technology has done for us is, first, we have our information technologies where we're able to certainly sense more about our crop, have more input information. We have another part of our information technology in that we understand the crop more. We have mathematical models that tell us how the crop will grow. It's been genetically bred through conventional and other breeding methods. And then our other types of technology are our mechanical technologies, how we get those inputs to the crop and how we remove those outputs. So technology helps us understand our crop more, to make decisions, and then to implement those decisions with better machines and better methods.
If you don't mind, Ken, let's run down some of those challenges. First of all, technology regarding water supply. I know, especially out in California during the drought, that was a major challenge, and it's a challenge in areas such as sub-Saharan Africa. How is technology facing that particular challenge?
Well, our technologies for delivering water are significantly improved, especially in the past decade or so. Just our irrigation systems, mechanics of our irrigation systems, how we can dose each plant with water. So we have the logistics and the mechanics of getting that water there. But we also have improved our crops. Our crops are being cultivated and bred so that they need less water. And we also are better able to sense the condition of the crop so that we can deliver water when it's needed and not in a way that is in any way wasteful.
Another aspect is fertilizers. I understand there's quite a bit of work being done in that area.
Absolutely. We are generating more targeted fertilizer mixes. Some of these are biologically derived. We're much better with our understanding of how the crop uses the fertilizer. And again, we're better at how we actually get the fertilizer to the plant.
Looking at pest and disease control, again, science has had to come to the rescue to keep these plants and crops safe from pests and diseases.
Absolutely. And it's one of the issues that we have with changing environments and changing climates is a changing pest complex. And we've always had new pests that to develop or come in, resistance that pests develop to our control methods, even if they're chemical or biological methods. Our pests are just as adaptable as we are, if not more adaptable. And so they change quickly. So this model of having better information, of being able to actually sense the crop condition and pests. With many of our drones or our remotely piloted aircraft, we can get much better visual input and sensory input on our crops to understand when we may have a pest condition developing. We have mathematical models that look at the weather, that look at the crop and the stage of growth, that again can alert us to when we may have a pest condition that's developing. And then we have better ways to actually get these control methods out, be it a spray, be it some modification of the plant. So again, it's this model that we have of better mathematical knowledge, biological knowledge, better sensory inputs, better processing of this information. And finally, as we say, where the rubber hits the road, getting what the crop needs to that point at the right time.
One thing that we have in this particular generation that generations before us didn't really have was satellites and their use in weather and other issues. How have satellites played a role in agriculture?
Tremendous role. First, the very simple things is what it's done for our navigation. We now have the ability to really know where everything is on our farm, to know where all our vehicles are, where our workers are, or all of this is satellite navigation. For example, our rows can be very straight now, which makes our cultivation and our planting much easier. Our trees can be in a straight line. We know where every tree is. We can know what it's producing. So that basic utility of navigation and knowing where everything is has tremendously changed how we manage every aspect of the crop, and especially all the equipment that's going in. So that's our first use of the satellite. And now as we're beginning to get better and better satellite imagery, we can understand not only the crop, but the landforms around it, and certainly our weather prediction, the accuracy and our confidence in weather prediction due to our satellite information coming in on a very broad scale has tremendously assisted us in agriculture.
You had mentioned briefly communications technology, and what use does it have in agriculture? Cell phones, portable computers, and so forth.
Absolutely. One of my colleagues, Professor Bill Chancellor here at the University of California, decades ago, he realized that there is an energy value in information. And so if we know where things are, if we know the condition of something, for example, something as simple as, is one of our agricultural machines, is it full of fuel or is it low on fuel? That information can now be communicated. Is the engine healthy? And by knowing that, we can prevent wasted time. We can prevent that machine not being able to proceed in the field. And so as we are able to communicate, it allows us to prevent the waste of resources.
One area that seems to be growing quickly, and that's the use of robotics and automation. Has this technology impacted farming and agriculture yet?
I think we're just beginning to see some of the significant impacts in that area. As we are facing, in many parts of the world, shortages of labor that traditionally did the hand operations in agriculture. As we do have these labor pressures, what we see is a change in how the crops, in many cases, are even shaped. For example, our orchards now are being pruned differently. The configuration of the orchard is being changed so that it's easier for machines to come in and tend to those crops. And in many cases, the robots are not replacing the worker. The robots are assisting the worker, helping them get to the right location. We may have a worker that's still doing the very critical and very human-focused work of selecting a fruit and removing a fruit from the canopy. But then the robot is then taking that fruit back to the collection station, or it's packing that fruit, or it's maybe taking the worker to that point in the canopy. So we're beginning to see the concept of what's called cobots, kind of a co-worker robot with our human worker.
And finally, Ken, I'm sure you have your eyes on the horizon. What forms of technology, what kinds of technology are emerging that you see that can show great promise to agriculture?
Very good question. I think what we're seeing overall is a great increase in, for example, our positioning and navigation ability. When we first started with global positioning systems, maybe we were accurate to 50 meters. Now we can be accurate to centimeter levels. So as our resolution of navigation and positioning gets finer, we're able to do things on a crop where we in the past could not even dream of, say, manipulating maybe the pollination of the crop. There are people working on drones that are the size of bees for doing pollination on the crop. So we can sense and we can deliver inputs on a very fine scale that we haven't had before. And likewise, we can get this information on a very fine scale. So I think our ability to become much more precise and our ability to manipulate things on the crop mechanically is increasing greatly as we're seeing much more development of robotic fingers and sensors on a small scale. We also are seeing more ability to pull together information on a much larger and broader scale, kind of crowdsourcing information. We have more weather data coming in, certainly as our environment may be changing. Improved weather data on a smaller scale helps us manage those crops.
Ken Giles, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today and sharing your insights on agricultural technology.
Very happy to do so, Rick.
That was Ken Giles, a professor in the Department of Biological and Agricultural Engineering at the University of California, Davis, in Davis, California. Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. Today, we're talking about the use and impact of high technology in agriculture. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, or from iTunes. We also hope you'll get in touch with us either through Facebook and Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or by sending us an old-fashioned email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Now back to our program and on to our second of three segments. In this portion, we'll talk about the recent developments in agricultural biotechnology. My guest is Alan Van Dynes. He's also from the University of California, Davis. Alan, please tell us a bit about yourself and what you do at UC Davis.
I'm the research director for the Seed Biotechnology Center at UC Davis. I'm also the associate director for the Plant Breeding Center at Davis. We do a number of things at the Seed Biotechnology Centers. Basically, we focus on education, outreach, and research, basically in the seed and plant breeding industry. So we use the word biotechnology in say, the greater sense, where obviously more the literal sense, so anything to do that with biology, applying technology to biology. So we go from genomics to plant breeding to tissue culture to transgenics. We include those all in the word biotechnology. So some of the things we're working on, we focus mainly on California crops, which fortunately and unfortunately, that's about 250 plant commodities. But I've been focusing mainly on pepper and on spinach plant breeding and then applying genomic tools to those crops. We're focusing right now mainly on traditional plant breeding programs in both those crops. In pepper and spinach, we are looking at using new technologies like gene editing to look at functional genomics. So functional genomics is basically trying to figure out what genes do, and we can use those directly in regular, conventional breeding. We can, of course, use those directly as a source of genetic diversity for basically traits that we don't have access to, say, in the crossable germplasm. And so this is an exciting field for us to basically develop possibly quicker, maybe more cost-effective ways to improve genetic diversity in our plant breeding programs.
So in other words, when we're talking about seeds of the future, it isn't necessarily new breeds of plants or vegetables or fruits or whatever.
Well, that's exactly what we're talking about. They're new varieties, and every variety is unique in the sense that it'll grow differently. It'll have certain traits, just like every person is a little bit different, right? We're not at all like each other. Even twins are slightly different.
Alan, when we're talking about terms like plant breeding, genetic engineering, what are these phrases? What are these words? Are they the same thing? Are they different? What's the difference between, for example, plant breeding and genetic engineering?
Genetic engineering is a tool that can be used in plant breeding. So plant breeding has been going around since, the beginning of farming per se. There's three parts in plant breeding. There's generating genetic diversity, and that could be through traditional cross, and that's by far the vast majority of the way people use. You'll make a cross between, one variety that might have one trait like high yield, another one that have high quality, for example, and try to combine those, you know, in a single variety.
When you're doing genetic engineering or you're creating a specialized seed for use in the future, some of the factors, you may have mentioned one or two of them, but does food safety or upping the nutritional value play any role in your decisions on these seeds?
So the answer is yes, and then really anything is possible. But when you say seeds of the future, these are seeds of today. They're not seeds of the future.
Okay.
The genetic engineering, or I like to use the word transgenics, they've been around commercially since 1995, you know, in more of the field crops, certainly not in so much in vegetable crops. There's only a few cases in vegetable or fruit crops. Papaya, for example, has been around since the 90s, and that's resistance to a pathogen that would have devastated the crop and basically probably eliminated the crop from the island of Hawaii, you know, and that's still used today. There's a small amount of squash that's being produced. Those are about the only two vegetable or fruit crops are out there right now. The rest are caught up in the, you know, in the main field crops, you know, that make up most of our food in a sense. You know, you have sugar beet, corn, maize, soybean, and cotton, and canola. You know, those are ingredient crops, the feed crops. And the traits that were included for transgenics for those have really, really revolutionized farming and also the cost of those goods, you know, certainly in the United States and in the countries that approve them. Unfortunately, not everybody has approved them for use, but it certainly has made a big difference worldwide, both on the cost and even the safety of goods in the context of some of the traits like BT, which is resistance to insects. The amount of chemical that being put on the crops that have BT resistance, like corn and cotton and canola, is drastically reduced compared, you know, to the past. And even when they are spraying things for herbicide resistance, other traits, the compounds they're using for herbicide resistance are much, much less toxic than some of the other chemicals that have been replaced. But again, transgenics is just an evolution in plant breeding. Plant breeding, people have been making crosses and selecting things for thousands of years, but formally in genetic basis, maybe only for about 100 years, 120 years since Mendel's laws have been rediscovered in the early 1900s. So genetic engineering, gene editing, cultivation, tissue culture, any of these technologies, high-throughput phenotyping, genomics, those are just tools in the plant breeding toolbox that plant breeders use to develop new crop varieties that, you know, with the goal is always to increase the quality, increase the yield, make them more climate resilient, meaning tolerance to heat, tolerance to cold, to drought, and other things. And all keeping in mind, of course, it has to be a marketable crop with good quality for the customer and take into account the environment as well. So plant breeders in general really have those things in mind every time they create a new variety. And this genetic engineering, as you're calling it, or transgenics, is just one of those tools that is used when needed.
Let me ask you about something that is fairly controversial, and that's GMOs, genetically modified organisms.
Right, and that's what I'm calling transgenics.
Okay. Now, why is there such a big controversy over these foods that's being produced? I mean, I remember when they were first being discussed, they were looked at as a possible solution to ending world hunger. So I understand it's been mired in controversy pretty much since they've become known.
I think, well, part of it has been totally hype, and that's what it's been. I mean, they've been proven safe by thousands, if not tens of thousands, of studies by National Academy of Sciences, by medical institutions, and so on. So there's no doubt whatsoever that they're safe. Part of it is, I'm not sure people, I would say half of it is people who are anti-corporate, whatever, the drive against Monsanto, if you want to call it. And so that's really half the thing, and people are saying, I don't want Monsanto to control my food. Well, in fact, you know, the people that control your food are more the grocers, not the seed companies. They're tiny companies and really have little influence. The grocers decide what goes on your shelf, right? You can't sell what the first consumer won't buy. So I'm not sure. And then part of it has been, honestly, movement, you know, for other marketing types. You know, organic has been against GMOs for some reason. That's their choice. The National Organic Act has been put together by people that decided these are the things that are in and these are the things that are out as far as organic. But, I mean, all the stuff you read on the Internet is just fear-mongering, essentially, and most of it is, for lack of a better word, is not true. I mean, it's just making up stuff. When you're not limited to facts like we are as scientists, it's easy to scare people.
Some of the concerns that people have expressed is the fact that there are possible hazards in eating a genetically modified food, such as allergies, for example. Have you heard any of that?
I've heard all of it, but again, it's unfounded. So everything that's commercial goes through a pretty regimented regulatory process. I would say the highest regulation process for any food in the world. The USDA decides whether or not if it's safe to grow. The Environmental Protection Agency in the United States, if you have a pesticidal property, so like resistance to an insect or resistance to a pest, to an herbicide, determines if there's any off-target effects. And the Food and Drug Administration determine if it's safe to eat, including allergies. So everything out there that's commercial has gone through this process and has been approved. And we have a very rigorous thing. So it's proven safe. A transgenic apple is no less safe than a non-transgenic apple. And that's the standard that they use. They do tests head-to-head, huge feeding studies, you know, environmental impacts, and also in growing. And they compare head-to-head over multiple locations in years, and they ask that question, is it the same as a non-transgenic version of that variety? And the answer has been yes for everything that's been approved.
Alan Van Dynes, thank you so much for taking time to join us today and provide your insights into agricultural biotechnology.
You're welcome. Thanks.
That was Alan Van Dynes. He's a plant geneticist and lead researcher with the Seed Biotechnology Center at the University of California, Davis in Davis, California. Joining me in our third and final segment to talk about technology's impact on global agriculture is Danielle Nierenberg. She's the president of an organization called Food Tank, which is headquartered in New Orleans, Louisiana. Food Tank describes themselves as a think tank for food. And according to their website, the people of Food Tank are building a global community for safe, healthy, and nourished eaters. Danielle, we've been hearing a lot about something called sustainable agriculture. And what is it? And can you give me some ideas of what's being done to implement and maintain sustainable agriculture?
Well, sustainable agriculture can be a lot of different things. It can comprise organic agriculture, regenerative systems. It's basically a form of agriculture that doesn't just extract from the earth, but restores nutrients. And farmers have been practicing this type of agriculture all over the world for centuries. Right now, in terms of the number of farmers who are practicing sustainable agriculture, it's hard to say, but you know, there are at least 500 million small family farms who are practicing some sustainable methods because they can't afford other techniques. They have to figure out ways to fertilize their soils naturally. They have to save seeds from year to year. They have to figure out ways that are easy and simple and inexpensive to combat drought and flooding and other extreme weather events. So sustainable agriculture is something that farmers have been doing for a long time.
Would you say that more people in developing than developed countries tend to use these techniques?
Sure. Again, small-scale farmers in the global south or the developing world, they practice sustainable agriculture in many cases because they have to. They can't afford to buy fertilizer out of a bag or buy other inputs. They really have to come up with techniques that don't cost them any money.
What about technology? Does technology play any kind of role in developing sustainable agriculture? And if so, some examples.
Sure, absolutely. Sustainable agriculture can comprise lots of different forms of technology. I think there's a growing movement to combine high and low tech and indigenous knowledge and traditional practices with some of these emerging and new technologies. The rise of cell phone and smartphone use over the last 10 or 15 years has really enabled farmers of all sizes to use data very differently. They've been able to use their phones to predict crop and livestock diseases. They're able to check markets for, you know, prices and figure out when the optimal time to take their crop to market is. They're able to make financial and banking transactions on their phones. And, you know, still have farms that are fairly small in size, but it just helps them do their jobs better. I think the question about any technology is, you know, who's in control of it and will it help farmers make more money, protect the environment, and really improve their livelihoods in different ways?
Do you see any new emerging technologies that show some promise?
Sure. I mean, I think the rise of artificial intelligence and big data have some really interesting things to hold for farmers. Using big data to predict what sorts of weather will be coming down the pike or to use drones and different robotics to help farmers look at their crops in different ways. I think those are really exciting technologies. Again, when you're looking at any technology, you want to make sure that farmers themselves are in control of it and that their privacy and their intellectual property is protected. But I think there are really some really exciting things that technology can hold for farmers.
One quote I remember reading that you had said was, not all science and tech is great in regard to agriculture. What did you mean by that?
Well, again, it's really who's in control. If farmers are in control of their data and how technology is being used and it's serving them, it's, you know, helping improve their incomes, helping send their kids to school, helping pay for health care, or if it's producing more nutritious crops. But I think in some cases, technology is, the power is controlled by large corporations, and that takes away a lot of power from farmers, and it takes away food sovereignty and, you know, the right to food. So we have to be, you know, careful to make sure that farmers are in the driver's seat when it comes to using different technologies.
You had mentioned high tech and low tech. Do you see these two forms of technology merging? And if so, can you give me some examples?
Well, again, we're already seeing it with the use of cell phones. You know, small scale farmers who are, you know, half a hectare or 5 hectares, they're able to use their cell phones to do all sorts of different things, make banking and financial transactions that they would have taken them, you know, years to do before, or being able to predict what to grow next year based on using weather data. So I think that's one example. Farmers are also using things like solar drip technology, right? They're using solar panels to power pumps that can then irrigate their crops very efficiently. I saw a really interesting farm in Niger a few years ago. It was run by about 50 women who had formed this cooperative under the guidance of a research organization, and they were growing traditional and indigenous crops along with fruit trees and other high-value crops. And before they had started the cooperative and were using this technology of solar drip irrigation, they were each making about $300 a year. Since they've all formed this cooperative, each of them is making about $1,500 a year because they're growing more, they're selling more. And when I asked these women how their lives, you know, had sort of changed since they formed the cooperative, they told me things like, you know, I was able to send my kids to school. I'm able to buy my husband a bicycle so that he can get to the farm where he works more easily. You know, they said things like, I'm fatter now. These women weren't fat, but they were eating better, and that's how they describe it. So, you know, some of these technologies can be really transformative and improve people's lives in really significant ways.
One issue that is definitely going to affect, if it hasn't already, agriculture is climate change. What about the impact of climate change on the food chain?
Absolutely. Farmers all over the world are already experiencing the effects of climate change, whether you live in the Midwest or you're a farmer in Malawi. And I think, you know, one thing that's come clear to me the more I travel and the more I speak to farmers all over the world is that the global north, you know, farmers here in the United States and in places like Europe have a lot to learn from what farmers have been experiencing in sub-Saharan Africa, Asia, and other countries, because those farmers have really been dealing with the effects of climate change for a long time. I think the drought in the Midwest here a few years ago and the drought that, you know, plagued California has led a lot of farmers to understand that they need to really, as I said before, diversify their cropping system. But you can't, you know, grow these monocultures and expect them to survive, whether it's almonds or corn and soybeans. In the face of climate change, we're really going to rethink how we produce food and actually what we consume. And this really means significant changes in policy. It means significant changes in practices on the farm. And these are all things that require, you know, years in some cases to achieve. But I think what climate change brings home is we don't have years. There's a real urgency. And we need to make some of these changes now so that we can adapt in a way that doesn't, you know, cause more hunger or malnutrition.
Danielle Nierenberg, I want to thank you so much for taking time to join us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Danielle Nierenberg, the president of an organization called Food Tank, which describes themselves as a think tank for food. Food Tank is headquartered in New Orleans, Louisiana. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank our two wonderful interns, Caroline Ring and Hannah Spicogna, for booking today's guests. And thanks to you for listening today. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.